pointed out, the subject today is the paradox of death. You mentioned death, and you would find that various people will have various things to say. They feel, some of them feel that, well, it is only of philosophical or academic importance. Some of them may say that it's a morbid subject, why talk about it? Student few years back was telling about after death state, and someone said, at your age, why are you worried about death? You should be thinking about other things. So people have different reactions as far as the death, subject of death is concerned. To carry on from where the first speaker left off, this encountering death every day. And as someone, a medical researcher and a physician, rightly pointed out, that when death happens on a grand scale or a great scale, it doesn't affect us very much. We can see that we sit at the dining table discussing about hundreds of people dying in war, famine, cyclones. We watch news on television, read in the newspaper about murders, suicides, without having to really blink back a tear. It's only when, as he says, when the number involved is small, and especially when the people involved are close to us, that we are set thinking as far as death is concerned. Now, one finds that, therefore, when we are awakened, when it is the death of a near and a dear one only. The other day in Bombay Times, there was the article, Encountering Death Every Day, A Doctor's Dilemma. And points of view of various doctors was mentioned. And one of them said that once when he had to sign 4 death certificates in a span of 15 minutes, it was very unsettling, benumbing, shocking. But then he says that by and by, I got along and, well, I am well insulated to handle death. Now, what is this well insulated is a very important question. It could be in 2 ways. We could be well insulated when we see death happening that we become so blunted and indifferent to any form of death. Or it could be well insulated because whenever we encounter death, in the family, out of the family, death happening at a distance, we asked right questions. We really tried to understand what is the place of death in our life. How is death related to life? And when we ask these questions and try to understand, instead of shrinking away from it, the importance, the presence, the position, the place that the death occupies in man's life, then, well, that would be well insulated in the sense of acquiring some amount of equanimity and knowledge so that we can take death when it happens without getting so shattered. Mostly when there is a death in the family, we know that no matter what philosophical background we have, we cry. We cry for 1 day, 2 days, 15 days, 3 months, and then of course, again, fall in line and live the life. We would like to hear, read a little bit of a longish paragraph, because the position which is, in which this author is, well known to us in a way, Professor C.S. Lewis, and if we know him, he was one person who has written a lot philosophically on all subjects. But when it came to really encountering and absorbing the shock of death of his wife, whom he loved very much, this is what he writes. Feelings and feelings and feelings. Let me try thinking instead. From the rational point of view, what new factor has my wife's death introduced into the problem of universe? What ground has it given me for doubting all that I believed? I knew already that these things and words happen daily. I would have said that I had taken them into account. I had been warned. I had warned myself not to reckon on worldly happiness. And being a Christian, he says, we were even promised sufferings. They were part of the program. We were even told, blessed are they that mourn. And I accepted it. So really, I have got nothing that I hadn't bargained for. Of course, it is different when the thing happens to oneself and not to others. And in reality and not in imagination. Yes, but should it for a sane man make such a difference as this? No, and it would not for a man whose faith had been real faith, whose concern for other people's sorrows had been real concern. The case is too plain. If my house has collapsed at one blow, that is because it was house of cards. The faith which took these things into account was not faith but imagination. The taking them into account was not real sympathy. If I had really cared, as I thought I did, about the sorrows of the world, I should not have been so overwhelmed when my own sorrow came. It has been an imaginary faith, playing with innocuous counters like illness, pain, death and loneliness. So the message, the implication is very plain, that when it happens to others, maybe we didn't really try to sympathize enough to understand what was it that they were passing through. Not only death, pain, loneliness, all of this, when it is encountered by others, it is, yes, it is from a distance. And that is why when it comes to us, we are so shattered, as this author points out. And that's why Gita says, meditation upon birth, death, decay, sickness and error. And this meditation is not meditation at a set time, kind of, but it's the meditation which we can continuously undertake. And in fact, life offers us opportunity to undertake this meditation upon birth, death, decay, sickness and so on. Because moment to moment we can meditate. It could be a simple thing like you break a beautiful vase to which you are attached to. And let us not really make a mistake. People are attached to these things so much that for weeks together they'll talk about breaking a beautiful vase. It could be that. It could be tearing a beautiful dress or a suit. It could be breaking up a relationship on which we have counted so much. And finally, it could be the death of a near and a dear person. All of these are opportunities for really reflecting. As Buddha says, impermanent are all conditioned things. And it's an experience to go at the crematorium and watch the cremation of people, not only whom we may have loved, but whom we thought to be very exceptional. People we thought were very knowledgeable. They kind of stood like a pillar through difficult times of life. Then we watched them, that in a jiffy, that body was reduced to ashes by the flames of the crematorium. And you wonder, where is Mr. So-and-so, who was like standing like a rock of Gibraltar? Now, this is an important experience. One finds that when it shows that there are forces in nature which are more powerful than the most powerful man, and it leaves a sort of emptiness. Now, why does it leave this sort of emptiness? That is because, as when Job asked in the Bible, that when a man dies, does he live again? And most of the time you find that the mystery of death, or shall we say the paradox of death, the meaning of death, the answer to all of these is concealed in the answer that we give to this question asked by Job. And well, you find here that it is not as if the ordinary man only is afraid of death. Michelangelo, for example, said that my life has been overshadowed all the time by thoughts of death. Some thinkers and scientists have felt that will all these achievements come to nothing? Will it be like dip and like a torch dipped into water, will it all vanish into thin air? And that is why there is fear. But the fear of death, the paradox of death, as we say, that a man, when he is dead, he is dead and yet not the dead. In a way, the dear departed one is lost and yet he is not lost. Now, the answer to these paradox and the fear is in trying to grasp the essential difference between what we call the human reality and the biological reality. That if we say man is only his body, then yes, everything ends with the body. But if we say man is body and in addition he is a soul, then there is a chance that something persists after death. Then again, the question could be, is man a body which has a soul, like a capsule in a jar, or is he a soul which has or uses the body? Or in a way, is the body which produces life, or is it that the body just reflects this life? And the analogy, two analogies are given, that the candle produces light, so that when the candle is blown out, the light is not there. But the mirror reflects light. And you take away the mirror, nothing happens to light. The light is still there. And this is the confusion that we have between the mirror and the light. This is the confusion between the personality and individuality. When the child is small, it slowly becomes aware of the surroundings. Then it becomes aware of itself being separate from the surroundings. Then there is that important but subtle shift from saying, baby wants the ball, John wants the ball, to saying, I want the ball. And so that recognition of the internal self, I, comes up. But unfortunately, as we grow up, this sense, this external sense of identity, is something which we are deriving. The real sense we feel is from the things which are surrounding us. So that as the philosopher David Cowan pointed out, that it is something like describing a hole in a piece of wood. You will not dare to describe the hole in a piece of wood in terms of the transparent air which fills the hole. How will you describe it? So you will say it is a round, brown, smooth hole. Now, is this hole really round? Is it brown? Is it smooth? No. It is the qualities of the wood that is roundness, smoothness. And so the hole's identity is derived from the qualities of the wood which surround the hole. And in the same way, he says that man derives his identity, unfortunately, in terms of his surroundings. He thinks he is the body. When you say, what is I? And immediately we say, oh, I am so and so, of so much height, so much weight, with this degree, with this education, and so on and so forth. And if we go a step further, we find that when this external sense of identity is the only sense of identity, then it is very dangerous. Because one of the fears of encountering death is that we feel that death is going to take away that body, personality, upon which we were depending upon our sense of I. Now the sense of self will go away when the death claims the body or personality. And we find that whereas in the life itself you find that this sense of identity, when it is derived from the externals, it is very, very risky because it requires nurturing. It requires constant maintenance. If you are deriving your sense of identity from, say, your encounter with people, you want that they should continuously, you will be doing things that will find their appreciation. You will not do something which will draw their criticism. Then you may measure your sense of identity from, say, the earthly goods, materials. Then what would be your whole life activities will be geared towards acquiring furniture, television, this brand of car, that brand of car. And you find that when the status which is associated with a particular car, say Maruti, has gone down, you want to exchange it for the other car. It will be Hyundai Santro now because everybody is praising that. So your whole I, yourself, your life, because the sense of identity is different, it is the life also works in a different way. So we see that, really speaking, this is very important that we should have the real sense of I. And identify, that word comes from the Latin identificare, meaning to make the same with. Now, as it's rightly pointed out, that the very fact that we have to make these things the same as I shows that they were not I to begin with. I have to say that, yes, this body is I, or this car, this bank balance is I. I am equating it to I. They are not the I to begin with. So, I think David Hume said that whenever I tried to find out who is I in the I am, I only stumbled upon conglomeration of my experiences, thoughts, and feelings, and so on. Of course, Immanuel Kant said that who is it that is carrying out this scrutiny in the first place? Aren't there two selves in man? And Thoreau said, yes, I am conscious of that presence of that self in me, which really is an experiencer, which is like a witness, which is not involved in these experiences. And therefore, when the drama of life, the play of life is over, I find that this self, which in a way is no self at all, which is no part of me at all, just goes his way. And for him, as far as he was concerned, the whole drama was just a work of imagination in which he was not concerned. And we find that the voice of the silence says that yes, our sense of identity goes much deeper than the personality. We are told that the shadows live and vanish. That which in thee which shall live forever, that which in thee knows, for it is knowledge, is not a fleeting life. It is the man that was, that is, and will be, for whom the hour shall never strike. So this at once shows that there is something which survives death. Death is not the finality. And that's why we find that in French, in the modern French, the word used for death is mort, for death. But in the old French, the word for death was trépas, that is a passage. So death is not seen as an end, but only as a bridge, a path which allows you to just cross over. And it is important that we recognize death as only a stage in this whole cycle of birth, death, decay, death, and again rebirth. And this is what we find in the very first quotation. The heart of the pagan understanding of death is the insight that birth, growth, death, and rebirth are a cycle that forms the underlying order of the universe. We can see the cycle manifest around us in every aspect of the natural world. Leaves drop to the ground, plants end their lifespan. Instantly, the processes of decay begin. As any good gardener knows, it is the processes of decay that sustain the fertility of the soil. All growth arises from death. This cycle of birth, growth, death, decay, and regeneration is the basic life-sustaining process on this planet. From the time of the emergence of human beings as thinking conscious species, people have understood death as a natural part of the cycle of life and have known, not through faith but through direct observation, that death is the matrix in which new life is born. Just very simply it is put that death is only one stage in this whole cycle. And naturally then that question arises that if something survives death, the first worry is that where are the dead? Then if they are there, if something of there remains, then how do we communicate with them? And people now things are a little different. But at that time they thought the only way they can get some proof, maybe they can come to know something about what happens on the other end of death, they used to hold this communication with the dead. And one of these things, one of the experiments, so to speak, the medium was asked to ask the so-called spirit that was visiting, that what is it like on the other side? And the so-called spirit said, well, it's very nice, it's very happy, very blissful. He also said that we can see everything that is going on there, on the other side of earth. We can hear you people, see you people. Now, is this true? Then theosophy says, we all know, first of all, we are all students and we need not go into the details of that it is not desirable. However anxious we are to know something about what is happening to our departed ones on the other end, we're told it's not desirable to get into this communication. But besides that, we know H.P. Blavatsky says that whereas it is true that it is a state of total, unalloyed bliss, and of course we must mind that it is not what comes to the seance room is not the real man, the spirit, but only the shell, what is left behind, the totally mundane and worldly desires of that dear departed one, that in a sort of kamarupic shell in that form comes to the seance room. But the real man is going to the other state, which we know as Devahan, which we know otherwise as Swarga or Paradise. But there it is, he is in an unalloyed bliss. And would it not be disturbed if he was, say, in communication with people on earth? And H.P.B. gives that example that suppose a woman dies, and then if she is able to look back, and it so happens that the husband is not bothered at all, he marries again immediately after her death, what would she feel? Would she feel happy, really? Would it be an unalloyed bliss? So it is not as if they are in touch. And yet we are told that very important passage which appears in the Key to Theosophy, We are promised another kind of contact which remains with the dear departed ones. We are told that during sleep, all of us do come into contact with the dead, the ones we are so anxious about. And sometimes we get up with a feeling of well-being that yes, everything is fine with that person. But unfortunately, since our minds are not receptive, we don't bring back this experience. And this is what this little bit long passage tells us in HPB's words. It says, it may be that occasionally we shall experience a different form of contact with one who has died. If our own thoughts and feelings are able to reach to the same state in which the other mind exists, there may be a strong feeling of communion translated by us into an extremely happy and a vivid dream. There is hardly a human being whose ego does not hold free intercourse during the sleep of his body with those whom it loved and lost. Yet, on account of the positiveness and non-receptivity of its physical envelope and brain, no recollection or very dim dreamlike remembrance lingers in the memory of the person once awake. We are with those whom we have lost in material form, and far, far nearer to them now than when they were alive. For pure divine love is not merely the blossom of a human heart, but has its roots in eternity. Again, we say, love beyond the grave, illusion though we may call it, has a magic and divine potency which reacts on the living. A mother's ego, filled with love for the imaginary children it sees near itself, that love will always be felt by children in flesh. It will manifest in their dreams, and often in various events, in providential protections and escapes, for love is a strong shield and is not limited by space and time. So here we are told about how some sort of contact is there in a different form, of course. Now, naturally the question may arise, but first of all, why is death necessary? And so often we have spoken of that mythology, that Greek mythology of the god and the goddess who were in love with each other and they wanted to live forever and ever, and how they approached Zeus and they asked for the boon of immortality, but in the process they forgot to ask that they should not grow old. So they grow older and older, but they wouldn't die. So the agony which is felt is expressed by Tennyson in the two lines where he says, and after many a summer dies a swan, me alone cruel immortality consumes. This is what is there if we feel that we want to be immortal. Why is death required? And isn't there this book by Simone de Beauvoir, All Men Are Mortal? Some people may feel, okay, if I could live only, say, for 200 to 300 years, I can achieve so much more. There was this, in the novel, there was this emperor Raymond Fosca, and he thought he can do so much for his people in the city. So he drank the elixir of life. He lived for 200 years. He conquered many cities and built many houses and all that. But at the end, he realized and he confessed or concluded that, well, I don't think I have been able to achieve anything exceptional which people living for 70 or 80 years have not been able to achieve. So he said it is better, in fact, for the people to know that they are going to die one day. It's those people who would take life seriously. It's those people who would really live the life to its fullest in a most worthy manner and maybe achieve something really useful and worthwhile. Now, the main reason we know how Mr. Judge says that there is that aspect in us which we have been seeing, for which working through this personality, astral body, physical body, brain, it is a torment. It is not the home for that aspect in us. And so he says, as H.P. Blavatsky points out, for that aspect in man, death comes as a deliverer and a friend. And in The Ocean of Theosophy, Mr. Judge gives us another reason. He says that our soul gets tired out, just like the body gets tired out, the soul is tired out. Because in a given life, we all know we have so many aspirations. We have the aspiration to do a lot of social work, maybe aspiration to learn music, astrology, it could be just aspiration to learn a lot of computers, very mundane to very high. Aspirations, desires, lots of wishes are there. But how much are we able to fulfill? And it is because these noble or not noble aspirations and desires are there, they are not lost. All of these are stored as unexpended impulses, energy in the mind. And it is these which he calls in the ocean of theosophy, which will not find their kind of fruition in the, under the chilling skies of earth. These are the ones which we ideate upon. We are all familiar with this whole concept of Devahan, where just like the eaten food gets assimilated into blood, bone and tissues, we are told that all the noble things are expanded, ideated upon, and they become part of the soul. So here again, that very important question comes. Leonardo da Vinci said that just like a well-spent day gives joy to sleep, we would say not joy but also meaning to sleep, similarly he says that the well-spent life gives joy and meaning to death. And we know therefore that life and death are interrelated. It's not as if you can study one without taking into account the other. We always say that the after-death state are the state of effects, and what is the kind of after-death state you will have depends upon the kind of life you live. If you have lived colorful life, as Mr. Jat says, your Devahan, your Swarga period will be also colorful. If it was an insipid, colorless life, so will be your Devahan. And various examples are given. A person who is, say, a materialist, who really did not pay attention to spiritual things, for him, it is as good as having no Devahan at all. Then a person who lived a rich life, who always, say, had a kind of thought for those who are less fortunate, we are told how it is love, sympathy, altruism, mercy. These are the things which the soul takes with itself to Devahan. As HPB says, it is the tendrils of sympathy which attach itself to the ego of man and there find more expression so that the man comes back enriched with these qualities. And then there is a rank materialist who never shed a tear for anyone in life. And for him, well, there is no Devahan. He is born almost immediately. And here we may pause and therefore consider that how important it is as to what is the life lived. Because it also therefore becomes very important as to whether we think that there is a state after death or whether we feel that this life is the only life is going to be of importance. Like in the Key to Theosophy, she says, some people feel that, well, this is a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury signifying nothing. If this is the idea of life we have, then, well, that's the kind of life we are going to live. As the American attorney, Clarence Darrow, he felt similarly. He felt that, well, man's life is like a ship, a rudderless boat, which is tossed here and there, hither and thither on the ocean. One fine day, it sinks into oblivion and nobody knows about it. This is not how man's life is. Everything doesn't come to an end, we saw. And we've often told this story, but very surprisingly, Leo Tolstoy had some similar thing, idea about man's life. In fact, he compares man's life with the Eastern traveler. The story of the Eastern traveler is that there was this traveler traveling. Behind him, there was a beast following him. So he started running and he came upon a well. Well, he thought he'll jump into the well and save himself. He looked into the well and he saw that there was a dragon with the open jaws. So he realized that if I jump in, I'm going to die. So he jumped in and held on to the twig of a tree that was growing from the cleft of the wall of the well. Now as he was hanging on to this twig, he saw that the two mice were nibbling on that very twig that he was holding on to. So this was that every which way you lose situation. This does bring out very nicely the inevitability of physical death. That no matter what you do, that death is there. It is in the very fabric, framework and pattern of the universe. You can't escape physical death. Then he goes on that as he was hanging, he saw that two drops of honey were there on the leaf. So he started licking it. Then meanwhile, what to do? So he started licking. And Tolstoy says that, well, I have been doing just that, licking the two drops of honey in my life. One is my love for writing books and the other is my love for family. But it's very sad that he felt that all the time, however, I have been saddened a bit to know that all of these will come to nothing because life will claim us one day Because that whole idea that he had was that with life, everything will, I mean, with death, everything will come to an end. And so, fortunately for him, he still continued to write good books and things like that. Unfortunately, it can happen. If you have this idea of life, I mean, of death, you may tend to take a course where we find people saying, "Are kya, what philosophy you're talking about? Who has seen tomorrow? So eat, drink and be merry. Make hay as the, while the sun shines." This is the idea people have. And therefore, all the life is wasted. If not really in committing, say, crimes or being really bad, but at least it is in following the things which are totally of no value at all. People may be spending their whole lives just learning different kinds of wines, you know. They are the connoisseurs of wine. They are the gourmets of food. And you name and there is a field in which people have excelled themselves. A whole life is spent just in doing that. And what does it amount to? Sometimes it can be just intellectual pursuit, totally intellectual pursuit. A computer field nowadays which comes to our mind. People are wizards of computers. And having no thought at all for other people, for something spiritual of life, spiritual in life. And that can, not just in one life, but in lives to come, lead to what H.P. Blavatsky calls in her Isis Unveiled, spiritual death. So how beautifully she explains or brings this out. But there is another death, which is the interruption of the divine order and the destruction of every human element in man's nature and every possibility of human happiness. This is the spiritual death, which takes place before the dissolution of the body. There may be a vast development of man's natural mind without that development being accompanied by a particle of love of God or of unselfish love of man. When one falls into the love of the self and the love of the world with its pleasures, losing the divine love of God and of the neighbor, he falls from life to death, as was pointed out by the first speaker in the preliminary remarks. The higher principles which constitute the essential elements of his humanity perish, and he lives only on the natural plane of his faculties. Physically he exists, spiritually he is dead. The tireless pursuit of riches, of the amusements and entertainments of the social life, the cultivation of graces of manner, of taste in dress, of social preferment, of scientific distinction, intoxicate and enrapture these dead alive. But these creatures, with all their graces, rich attire and brilliant accomplishments, are dead in the eye of the Lord and the angels. And when measured by the only true and immutable standard, have no more genuine life than skeletons whose flesh has turned to dust. This is a different kind of death. And in fact, it is only this kind of death that we need to worry about. That we needn't worry about physical death, which we saw is inevitable, about which we can do nothing. But yes, something can be done about this death, which should not take place. And even if we say don't take physical death as finality, even if we take it as a change, we know how we dread even change in our lives. We want that things should go on in the same way. We want that, the illusion should continue. If there is something we have to tell another person, and if you feel that it's going to alter your relationship, maybe it's going to totally break the relationship, see how reluctant we are to tell that thing, because we don't want that change to occur. So also, as a child, if we had our way, we would not have grown into an adult. As a youthful person, if we had our way, and some of us do cling to try and look as youthful as possible, even at the age of 50 and 60, we wouldn't want to live even at that youthful state. But yet, we find that change is forced. And this change is very much required in spiritual life. As the voice of the silence says, from the furnace of man's life and its smoke, winged fames arise. That there is some aspect of our lives which is like this, which needs to be burnt, which needs to be transformed, so that the better thing can take its place. Because we should not always look at death as end, but as Shiva has been shown to destroy in order to regenerate. He told in letters that have helped me that a one who is following the path of spirituality, there is death which he will encounter every now and then, at every step. As Jasper Niman says, that the sheaths of the soul break one by one. And if you are really earnest, And if you take stock of where you are, at the end of a year, at the end of sometimes 6 months or even a week, things can happen. And if you turn back and look, you find you were such a different person and how different you are. As he uses the very word, a new self arises before you. So there is this continuous moment-to-moment death as far as the life of spirit is concerned. What has death to teach us? Now at the end we may ask that, one, death teaches, or rather we can take it that it is a test, as we saw in Professor C.S. Lewis's that paragraph which we read out, it is a test of our faith. Many people are very, very pious. They would not really live a day when they will not, say, put a light in front of the God. Very pious. And then there are people who are philosophically at least very pious, in the sense of really understanding, very earnestly and sincerely accepting the God, the law. Yes, nothing can come to me which I have not deserved. And yet, where is that faith? Suddenly you find that a near and dear one is taken away, and people have overnight turned into atheists. What happens to that faith? As again, Professor C.S. Lewis later on in his book, A Grief Observed, points out, he says that that faith was not real faith somehow. So long as I was shown a rope and told that you have to tie a box with it, I said, without thinking, I said, yes, yes, it's a sturdy rope. But when they said that you have to hang by that rope on the precipice, well, I would have to think about it. That is true about our faith. We feel that we have faith in the law, in the God. But when such things come in life, our faith is put to test, as it were, how much we believe in it. And death, of course, teaches, we shall say, that detached attachment. That you should be attached, no doubt, but it should be a detached attachment. We see that how attached we grow to things in life. It could be a simplest television set, it could be our stereo system, it could be our books, and if one of them is not there, out of order for some time, and you are all panicky, you feel you have ceased to exist without them. We have to, as someone said, stop being so other-possessed. We are really possessed by them. We are so dependent upon them. It's not as if you shouldn't love these things, but you should not get dependent upon them. And as someone has pointed out, again, it may look like a very morbid kind of a meditation, but it's a meditation wherein he says, you can actually, while these people that you love so much are alive, you can take them up one by one and say that in your mind's eye, you can see them as going away from you, departing, and then separating from you forever, and say goodbye in all earnestness. In the beginning, maybe, he says, you will feel that there is pain. Then it will give place to some sort of loneliness, some sort of solitude. But when you learn to grapple with this solitude, slowly a kind of peace descends. Now, this is one of the things that is suggested by some person. And of course, Crosby says that I used to imagine myself as all alone, as bereft of all recognition, and like having to battle with life absolutely alone. And he says that those very things have happened to me. Now, this is also not easy. It's not that he was encountering death, but being all alone and really taking life all alone. But he said, because I had imagined it and passed through it all in my imagination, when it happened, I was not so shaken. Now, these are just hints given by people, but we know it is difficult to develop this detached attachment. And as one place someone has suggested, that it may be because we need to transform our very idea of love. That we need to have a little more mature idea of love. Love on a different plane. And the thing is quoted from the brothers Karamazov, the brother Zosima. He is supposed to have said that it's because people are such that in a modern world they criticize everything which can't be explained by rational things, and therefore their love also is reduced, it is limited. They are not able to see beyond the things which are tangible. And this is true. Because we are dependent upon rational proofs, on things which are tangible, our love also is limited to the personality. And as from this platform perhaps it was said once, we are so poor at holding on to things non-physical. It's true. We are so poor at holding on to things non-physical. That requires that this love has to, in a way, grow and mature in a different sense. As it is said, Mrs. Zosima in Brothers Karamazov points out, the more spiritually alive we are, the more immortality of the soul will seem to us as a basic truth and not requiring any proof. As your love grows, you will become more convinced of God's existence and the immortality of the soul. It speaks of a different kind of love, which we need to, of course, as Sri Krishna points out, that the difficulty of mortals in trying to worship the unmanifest is that this body comes into the way. That is the whole problem. In understanding even this kind of love, it is the personality that we are clinging to. And one thinks of the Ishavasya Upanishad, the very first shloka, which says, Ishavasyam idam sarvam tena tyaktena bhunjitam. The life that has to be lived is knowing that the God is there in every atom and yet enjoying everything as though nothing belongs to you. Tomorrow it can go and yet I will not be ruffled. I mean, these are the things which are said, again, easier said than done, but they can be kept in mind. And as for this, one just thought of the very first article in Vernal Blooms, Yours Till Death and After, that how was it, what was it when Mr. Judge met H.P. Blavatsky? Was it the personality that he recognized? What he says, it was her eye that attracted me. The eye of one whom I must have known in lives long passed away. And she looked at me in recognition at that first hour. What was this recognition? So the moment we try to, say, lift ourselves a little, we find this may be the sort of soul recognition can come. And then we will not be worried about the personality being there or not being there. We'd just like to end this thing with, again, from the same thing, What Is Death, written by some author. He just gives us how we can make use of this very thing, knowing that death is going to come and life is transitory. How do you make use of it? Death can teach us to truly appreciate and savor life, because we know that our lives are short. We must fully enter into each moment. The fear of loss and the pain of mourning can make us turn away from the world, but the pagan way is to honor the fleeting nature of life's gifts, to know that their very briefness gives life a poignant beauty. Plastic flowers do not fade, but they do not give us charm of the living blossoms. We can not drift along, waiting for our real lives to begin at some time in the future. We must acknowledge at every moment that this is it, not the rehearsal, but the big concert. Friends, there is hardly any time for questions. This is a very difficult question. The question is that it was said that death comes as a deliverer and a friend for the soul. But what happens to the children who die? Then what happens, what about the untimely death? Is it really death coming as a deliverer and a friend? Well, this was just one of the reasons which Mr. Judge has given out. It is the reason which is given out in case of the normal death of the person, that yes, when the life is lived, there's so much gathered that a time is required to, say, reflect upon it, to make it a part and parcel. But then there are so many different kinds of karma that we have created, and therefore different kinds of karma need also to be settled, especially if you take the infant death. One of the pamphlets, the very question is asked, that how do you explain infant death? And two reasons Mr. Judge has given. One is that it could be a lesson for the child that in some past life, the body was misused so much. Your own body or the body of someone else was misused so much that now the soul has to go through this experience of acquiring the body and yet just losing it almost immediately. And it could be the karma of the parents, that the parents have to learn something of acquiring the child, that in some life they did not really value the children. Maybe they neglected their children. Some such many things, the ways of karma are difficult to know. So it could be the lesson to learn on both the parts. So similarly, one can say about the untimely death. The reason is not just one, that it comes as a deliverer and a friend in the sense of having the soul having to have time to assimilate things. But there could be various reasons, and untimely death may appear to us as untimely, but maybe that is the thing. I mean, that's how that life was going to end. Nobody can say whether that accident death was really a natural one or it was cutting off. It's very difficult to say. I think our time is up, and I'd just like to close this with what we read from "The soul of man is the eternal. It is made of consciousness. It is made of feeling. It is made of life. It is made of vision. It is made of hearing. It is made of the earth. It is made of the waters. It is made of the air. It is made of the ether. The soul is made of this world and of the other world."